Hi, this is Patricia Lee Stodder with Marsha Rock. We're producing Service, Disabled Women Veterans in Transition. And today we have the honor of speaking with Dr. Bridget Cantrell, who's extremely important in writing about and helping veterans struggle with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Cantrell.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
Now, I would like to begin by asking you a very simple question, which isn't simple at all. I would like you, please, to tell us what exactly PTSD is, and in particular, because our project is about women, if you think there are any manifestations of it particularly unique to women.
Well, certainly. Post-traumatic stress, first of all, is not a mental illness. I make that statement. I have been saying that for years, and I said it way before it became in vogue to say that, but it is not a mental illness, and it is a reaction to something that's outside the realm of a normal human experience. It encompasses behaviors, belief systems, physiological reactions, physical symptoms, spiritual conflicts, and it's a way of people dealing with something that is so horrific that there are literally no words in our vocabulary to describe the incident effectively.
It's very interesting that you say that, because you're stealing my thunder in a wonderful way, because one of my later questions was, how can anyone intelligent, sensitive, courageous, and brave go through what our soldiers go through and not have an enormous reaction?
Well, I say it's impossible. You are going to be changed by these experiences. And let's say, for example, even if you and I were going to be going on a humanitarian mission, and we were going to another country and where we're not used to the culture or the language, the food, whatever it is, and we see things that are beyond our reality to even make sense of, perhaps severe poverty, illnesses, diseases that in our country are eradicated. So we go off and we do our mission. We're going to be changed by that experience. And you take our combat veterans, are men and women in uniform, and we subject them to things that are indescribable. They literally cannot describe in words the things that they experience emotionally, spiritually, physically. They can't describe the scene effectively. So, because we don't have that frame of reference, we here on the home front, not even in our wildest imaginations, can even conceptualize what they have experienced.
Are there unique characteristics that you see manifesting more in women than men?
Well, yes. You know, there are some statistics out there. Studies looking at female versus male warriors. And just by the fact a woman puts on a uniform and they're put into situations where historically they're not part of that group. Women are 2 to 4 times likely to have post-traumatic stress symptoms as a result of their service, both in peacetime and wartime, as a male warrior. One of the things that we have to understand is that the sense of personal safety, that's paramount in someone getting through something. If they feel like they have a support system, and you always hear the old saying, I've got your back. If the people that they're in service with have their back, they're going to deal much better and more effectively with the stress that they're subjected to if they know that the people that they're engaged with have their back. They're there to help them, to protect, and to take them out of danger if they get wounded or whatever. But see, some of the women that I work with, they're put into situations where sometimes they're actually in a hostile work environment. They're put into maybe some units that are not used to having female warriors in their numbers. So they do things to kind of haze them and make their jobs much more difficult. And so the female warriors sometimes feel like their fellow soldiers don't have their backs. They don't feel safe completely because they don't feel like they're 100% part of the group.
Yes, we have spoken with many women who talk about that in terms of simple terms, more benign terms like you're describing, and also in terms literally of military sexual trauma, which has
yes.
given them an extra burden. I have often wondered if the emotional armor one learns to put on to be effective in a war combat situation, because this is a frontless war, so everybody's in combat. Is this same emotional armor that works so well for one in war a problem when they return home?
Certainly it is. And we know that what happens is women, when we get depressed, just in general, we get more withdrawn. Men get more irritable and agitated. They're more out there. We kind of tend to isolate and withdraw more. And so the women that I have worked with and that I know personally have come home to a situation where everybody kind of expects them to get back into their roles of being a mom, a sister, a wife, a girlfriend, and they're not given validation that, wow, you know, they were subjected to some pretty horrific stuff. And they have issues that have come home with them. They're not given the the sense of respite that they need in order just to get their back in sync. So I think the demands on our female warriors is much more intense because people don't give them the credibility or the validation that they deserve. When we look at archetypes, women are by nature, we're the nurturers. If a little kid gets hurt, we're going to pick them up and blow off their alley and pat them on the little rear and tell them to get back out in the fight. And when they come home, that's what everybody expects them to do, is to get right back into that role, and really minimizes the impact of their experiences.
Why aren't military families getting more information about how it is appropriate to open their arms to their returning warriors in a fashion that actually comforts them rather than completely freaks them out?
I don't think there's one answer to that. I think historically the military has been male-dominated. And so there's all these old kind of expressions. Pick yourself up by your bootstraps. Don't let them see you sweat. Real men don't cry or eat quiche or whatever. And we all know that's not true. And so I think those kind of stereotypes, those kind of old belief systems still hold true even today, because it's a male-dominated profession. 15% of our active duty are now females, and that's on the rise. And so I think that as a result of that, our families, because we're, children of World War II or Korean War veterans or Vietnam veterans, we have not had the exposure to looking at this and saying, wow, you know, when the soldier goes to war, the whole family goes to war. The whole family is affected and changed. And I think we're more than ever embracing that concept. But I think it's a very, very difficult concept to change. But I do know from my experience of working, like, with MarineParents.com, I'm their PTSD expert, and once a month I'm on a chat room, and it's all for parents. And I'm telling you, the parents are just lost. They just don't know what to do when their children come home from war. They don't know how to love them because they're afraid to be too loving, for fear of being pushed away, because we know that because of the context of war, you don't want to open yourself up too much emotionally, because if you did, you wouldn't be able to do your jobs effectively. So you push away those emotions, and oftentimes we substitute the more tender emotions of grief and loss and sadness. We substitute those emotions, our warriors do, with anger and aggression, because that's what's necessary in order to get through what they have to get through. And when the lights go out at night, and after they come home from a battle or whatever, then that's when they start to feel. And so I think those kinds of belief systems and the stereotypes that we've lived with and the expectations of the people on the home front, as well as the warriors themselves, are sometimes out of sync. and not in touch with really what do they need in order to effectively, truly come home. Meaning coming home, how do they reconnect with themselves? How do they reconnect with their communities? How do they reconnect with their spiritual side? You know, so many times we have conflicts in that way because they feel, well, you know, if there was a God, if there was a creator, if there was a source bigger than myself, why would they let these things happen? And so it's very, very difficult sometimes for our warriors to come home and feel like they're connected with all of those concepts.
Well,
all those things are necessary in order to really make it through these processes effectively.
I've observed, and I want to hear what you have to say about it, in the women in our film, one of our women, several of our women have kids, but one of them in a particularly poignant to me, I'm a mom, moment, said that her service dog was a solution for her, not for the reasons, many of the reasons we've all heard about, that we know about, just being a really good invisible injury therapy dog, but that for the first time she knew her kids could go to school and not be worried about her.
Uh-huh.
And that seems to me a double whammy of mommyhood. On the one hand, you've got your kids there, used to their mom taking care of them, and all of a sudden mom needs care, and kids are parenting mom, and mom feels lousy about that. Can you elaborate on that kind of configuration and how you actually start to deal with that?
Absolutely. That goes along with the roles that the expectations we have of ourselves. So many of our females, they come home from their combat experiences, even if they're not even outside the wire, just being deployed to the rear area. It doesn't matter. They come home from their deployments, and maybe they're having some issues with their post-traumatic stress, which I would expect. That's to be expected. And the kids are going, Mommy, Mommy, you know, I'm so glad you're home. And sometimes the conflict inside our females especially are, okay, I'm glad I'm home, but don't get too close to me. I don't want to be smothered. Just, you know, stay away. I don't feel like I can connect with you. And so our female warriors, that really hurts them to the core of their soul because they know they just don't have the resiliency to step up to the plate and be the mommy they were or want to be. And so so maybe they go into a shell. Maybe they regress and they go into a self-comfort mode where they withdraw. Maybe they start using maybe alcohol or drugs or other avenues of isolation and detachment just to make it through these issues that they're trying to deal with. Maybe they're sleep deprived and they just don't have the energy on any level to put forth to parenting their children. So then the children are seeing this, and it's a very painful thing. We're seeing regressive behaviors in some of our children. They're starting to bully. They're starting to show cognitive deficits, and because of their anxiety level or their own depression, and their grades are starting to go down. Maybe they're starting to use drugs and alcohol. We're seeing some of our children starting to join gangs and do tagging. I saw that in Hawaii when I was there with the 25th Infantry Division. So our children are very affected, and they are switching on these roles of the caretaker. The story you're saying about, is it the dog's name is Lila?
I was speaking of Alexis and Sooner, and in our interview with her, Alexis talks about once Sooner was there and she started feeling better, the kids were much more, she was so much happier because her kids were so much more comfortable with her being okay while they were gone.
The burden was lifted, and our children carry the burden. When the parents, I mean, even if you don't even have a deployed family, for example, and let's just say the parents are having a hard time, or one of the parents are having a hard time, the children bear that burden. They start blaming themselves. They start taking responsibility for the fact that their mom or dad aren't happy or not feeling well or are depressed. So this is a beautiful story in terms of how that relationship with that little dog, that animal, that friend, that confidant, that everything, that living life force, it lifted the burden of care off of the shoulders of the children. And it gave them a sense that, you know what, mommy's going to be okay. Mommy's got a companion that makes her feel better, that takes care of her. So I'm off duty when I'm at school.
Two of our women, both Alexis and Sue, also said that it was their children that pulled them through it. That if it hadn't been for their children, well, for Sue, she was in Walter Reed for 2 years, learning how to walk again on prosthetic legs. If it hadn't been for the kids, she doesn't know if she'd have the energy. And the same Alexis, dealing with her PTSD.
That's reconnecting with relationships. That's reconnecting with something that's larger than ourselves. And we, who are mothers, we know we have a tremendous responsibility to be there for our children. And we want to be there for them as long as we can be, and to parent them. So they grasp on to the concept of, this is my meaning and my purpose in my life right now. I can't give up. I've got my children to keep, you know, living for. I want to see them grow, graduate from high school. I want to see them get married. I want to see my grandbabies. So this is the way that people reconnect with something that's larger than themselves.
It's not such a positive story for our women vets reconnecting with their husbands.
That's right. We know that the divorce rate is huge, and the domestic violence rate is just tremendous. And also, child abuse is 3 to 4 times higher in deployed families, and it's usually the female at home that is the perpetrator because the stress level. So these are the wives that are home while their husbands are deployed. So, yes, when our warriors come home from their deployments, there's a major dissonance between the relationship, between the expectations and the assumptions that, you know, I'm going to come home, I'm going to take off my uniform, I'm going to get right back into the saddle, and we're going to be good to go. We're going to be back where we were before.
Speaking of getting back in the saddle, one of the things I really, really took note of was when you said about couples, married couples, when you come home, date. Don't expect to just tumble into bed together again and have everything be hunky-dory.
Well, they have to live in the present, right? Because they're really dealing and struggling with a lot of issues. And even the relationships that they formed when they were downrange are so intense and so tight. They're unlike any relationship that you and I will ever know in our lifetime. And so when they come home, their heart is still with their guys and their women that are still downrange, because they know when they're not there, so things are still going on, and they feel accountable to that. So part of them, their boots are pointed in the other direction. Even though they're here physically, they're spiritually not here with us. And so they do need time to transition. And so when I have couples coming back together, I really encourage them starting on the friendship level again, just starting to kind of find out what's comfortable. Maybe it's no longer comfortable to go out to dinner or to a movie. Well, get a movie at home and just start gently, knowing that that person really needs a lot of comfort. And so start the friendship level again. And I know that even intimacy, even physical and emotional intimacy, can be very, very intimidating and very frightening for the person who's coming home, as well as for the person waiting for them. So it takes time to reestablish, where are we as a couple? Do we still have a relationship? Do you think we can still pull this together and deal with the issues in an appropriate way without hurting each other?
One thing I'm hearing from you that I heard in a different way from Alicia and Sue was they both said two things: how difficult it is to learn to do this and how important it is to learn to ask for help. On top of that, though, what I'm hearing you say is that the only way people can find their way back to each other is to talk about how they're feeling. And it sounds like you're saying, be comfortable saying, you know, I love you, but I'm messed up right now, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. That's hard to say to someone you love or who you hope still loves you, mm-hmm. right?
There are exceptions, and we don't want to overgeneralize saying the only way it is, because there's some people that do quite well with their readjustment issues, and there are some people that have more challenges. But I really want to bring home the point that this is not a sign that they're flawed, like there's something wrong with them, like this is a really major weakness in their personality structure. This is not the case at all. And when I work with my veterans, I normalize. Words are extremely important, but sometimes words can be very frightening and intimidating. And when we look at our people downrange, just even the posturing, the way their physical stance puts off a message, don't mess with me or whatever. And they bring that home with them, and it can be very intimidating to their family members and to their loved ones. But in the war zone, it's essential. It's something that gets people under control, puts people on notice that, wow, this person means business. But our men and women in uniform are oftentimes not aware of how they come across. But words are so important. And if you have a really good foundation, you can start sharing, you know, I love you, but you know what, I'm feeling really disconnected right now. Just give me some time. Several of my Vietnam veterans would say, you know what, if it wasn't for my wife all these years, I wouldn't be here right now. So there is light at the end of the tunnel, and there is an incredible soothing effect to relationships, but some of them are more toxic than others, and we really have to evaluate this. Is this a toxic relationship? Was this a relationship that was doomed before we even deployed? Because when things are not going well before deployment, well, when you're deployed, things get worse.
What do you think is the worst thing to do or best thing to do for husbands, parents, sisters, and brothers when their loved one comes back from war?
One of the best things to do is start talking before they even get home. Keep the dialogue going if at all possible. Ask them, what do you expect when you come home? What do you think? How do you want it to be? What are some of your expectations? And half the time, they're probably not going to know, because they don't know what it's like to be home. They don't. All they know is being with their guys and their women in uniform, and that's where they feel safe, where they feel effective and like they're doing something with meaning. And when they come home, they feel very, very lost. So I think just dialoguing, opening the dialogue and creating a sense of safety is very, very important. And abandoning expectations is also important. You know, sometimes I've had people call me, and when the war started, they were doing big, huge welcome home parties and all this stuff. And I'm just going, you know what, that's not a good thing. You know, some of our warriors just don't want to be around large groups of people because that's a trigger for them. And so really be sensitive to the needs of your warrior who's coming home. Sometimes you can be too over caring, where you almost infantilize the person that's coming home. You don't let them find their feet on the ground. I mean, it's like they can't get their anchor because everybody's trying to overcompensate and trying to be too over caring. So I think just let time take its course.
We had a vet who came home, and she wanted a little bit of a welcome, and she mm-hmm. said she got it for a day, and then her family pretty much ignored her, and it drove her crazy. She wasn't aware she had PTSD. She started to get extremely angry, and it ruined her relationship with her mother, and she ended up homeless.
I have a question in terms of something you said before that I'm interested in, which I'm just going to call pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even going to get on my bandwagon about how, gee, if a physician in MEPS missed it, how dare they not cover you for it? But I won't go that direction. I'll go a different direction, which is there's a lot of discussion now about people not getting their benefits because of pre-existing conditions.
Like, yes.
And I would like to hear your opinion on it.
That is a very touchy topic. And that gets my blood boiling in a matter of seconds, because we know in the past and probably in the present, and it's hopefully going to be changing rather quickly, that some people have been misdiagnosed. And if they are misdiagnosed with a pre-existing condition, then the VA are not responsible for service connecting them for their disability. And this is a huge injustice to our men and women in uniform. I think it requires that we educate our adjudicators how war affects our warriors, and they need to be sitting with our veterans who come back from war and talking to them about their experiences, and they need to hear how their rating decisions have negatively impacted their lives by giving them the incorrect diagnosis and being too hasty in their decision-making process. So when I'm doing my workshops around the country, I will tell the warriors, if you go to someone and they give you a personality disorder, and that's what a pre-existing condition is, I said, that's the kiss of death. And oftentimes they are misdiagnosed. It's like, we'll just give them a personality disorder rather than look at post-traumatic stress or depression or anxiety or whatever. We'll just give them this, and we don't have to be responsible for it. We who are out here pounding the pavement and supporting our veterans have a responsibility to make our voices heard and require that these adjudicators get educated and are well informed about how their rating decisions are going to affect the lives for the rest of their lives of our veterans.
And I know that we, Marcia and I, in our project telling the stories of these women by the women, not through us, that we certainly feel very strongly that anyone, whatever they were like before they enlisted and did their gave their service, deserves complete service from us, no matter, yeah. I mean, life is a pre-existing condition, isn't it?
It is. All of us.
Exactly. Now,
life experience. That's how we learn lessons, you know? If we didn't have some of the challenges we have along our life path, we would not have learned how to adapt and grow from our experiences. So that's why I say, you know, our post-traumatic stress is an opportunity to see ourselves as, wow, I can't believe that I was able to make it through that situation, and I've come through that, and look at what I've learned about myself. Look what I've learned about people. And it's a tremendous rite of passage. And that's one of the things that we miss in our culture. And we don't have rites of passage in our culture where our men and women in uniform, they don't have these times in their lives where they go through a threshold and then they go into another part of their lives. Native Americans, you know, they do ceremony, they do rites of passage, and they have that in place for their young men and women who come home from war. And it's a very, very important part of their reintegration process.
One of our vets is in therapy. She goes once a week. And she's really dedicated to it. It's really helped her tremendously. And she was telling us about some of the techniques she's learned to cope with her PTSD. One is grounding. I was wondering if you can explain what grounding is and if there are other techniques that the veterans who are listening to this can think about using to help them deal with their PTSD.
Certainly, the veterans who are listening to this know that they have severe anxiety, they get triggered. These are urban veterans coming home to urban settings, so there's many, many environmental stressors, traffic, trash along the way, road construction, loud noises, the smell of barbecue, I mean, just all of these things. So grounding is a way of settling. It's like internal. It's like it's the way of quieting down the nervous system. See, there's mental anxiety and there's physical anxiety. And grounding is a way of really establishing, like, okay, I am here in the present. I am not in Iraq. I'm not in Afghanistan. I'm not in Vietnam. I am right here in this moment in time. And doing some kind of a ritual. I know I do some of this with some of my veterans, and I think of a warm healing light coming down through the top of their head, and it's just this soothing warmth that comes down all the way through their bodies. And I do this long induction, and I say, and then you can feel, you know, you can feel your rear end on the seat of the chair. You can feel your feet on the ground, and it's a real grounding technique. Going up and leaning up against the wall with your hands extended and just pushing into the wall is another grounding technique, because you're connecting with something that's very physical. There's other techniques to quiet down anxiety. Some of those are meditation. Some of them are acupuncture. They're doing yoga. They're finding yoga is very effective. Writing out your story, just letting your pen flow without editing, just free flow writing. And that's another way. And no one has to read that. Maybe you want to do a ritual where you take it out and you burn it and you dedicate it to the ocean and let it go out to sea. There's techniques of different types of techniques of cognitive behavioral stuff, where you think about your irrational thoughts. You know, you're trying to go, well, that's really a rational thought. That was a fireworks I heard. That wasn't an incoming RPG. So there's ways of just quieting. It's the objective is to quiet, to settle, and to realize that we're here in this present time, and also to think of the future, inspire hope, have something to look forward to. And the objective with treatment is also, like, say, the triggers. They're to recognize them, be aware of them, and not allow them to take you off into a full-blown flashback, but to mitigate them and say, oh, okay, wow, okay, we got through that. And give yourself credit for every little step you take that helps quiet this process.
The problem of the stigma of therapy for veterans. The reason they're not going to get any help with their PTSD is the stigma of therapy. They don't want to be seen as weak, or they don't want it on their record.
I know that. And I know, and it is, and especially a female, because there's already these stereotypes going on about the female warriors. It is my prayer and my hope that we will change that. We're not going to stand for stigmas to stop and prevent our warriors from getting the help that they need. However, the other part of this is help comes in all forms. Help can be an old veteran, an older veteran that has been there, done that, that just wants to take you out for coffee, and you just start telling your story. You start talking. You start building a relationship. Help comes from the dog, the relationship you build from your service animal or your animals in your life. Help comes from the old man that you saw walking across the parking lot, and you stop him and you thank him for his service, and he reciprocates that. So those are ways of connecting.
I have observed at the least expected moments when the friend I'm with is in the midst of a trigger that not only was obviously I wasn't aware of, but they weren't aware of. One was, we were interviewing a woman in our film, and Marcia went to get a lens, and she said to me, I don't know what's making me feel so weird and nervous. And all of a sudden it just clicked with me, and I said, well, it's really hot and we're sitting on a beach in the sand. And she was like, oh my God. And I was like, oh, I didn't mean to talk about a trigger, but it just, like, you know, and she was cool with that.
I want to thank you as a friend to your friend that you were insightful enough to tell her, oh, well, wait, look, we're sitting on the sand, it's hot. This is what I'm talking about when I talk to people about being a team. You know, you want to be a unified front, whether you're a friend, a lover, a spouse, a parent, a child, whatever it is. You want to be useful. You want to be someone that's going to help be a grounding force in that person's life. And so by you saying that, that was a wonderful gift you gave her. Because she says, wow, you brought her back just by defining what it could possibly have been. Because she didn't have any idea.
To me, her reaction was, I felt wonderful. That I mean, it's as It really goes both ways. That's the nice thing about relationships,
sure,
right? It really
That's
goes.
Right.
It really goes both ways. And if you let someone help you out, even if they didn't know they were doing it while they did it, that's a really nice thing.
If you're feeling uncomfortable, you know, going out to the grocery store, or you're not sleeping well, or you need something to kind of make you sleep better, maybe you need the TV on or a fan, some white noise, let your person know, you know, honey, this is what I need. I can't explain it, but this is just what I need. And for us who are civilians, to be brought into that fold and to be trusted is like what you're saying. It is such a privilege as a civilian to be of some use, to be like, it's really heartwarming, and it is a relationship.
So
both ways.
The trust issue came up in our conversation with our vets. Why is it so hard for them to trust people?
It's a matter of, I think it's correlated with loss. So you go downrange, you do what you do, you train hard, you party hard, you just really bond on these tremendous levels. And let's say you lose somebody, and then you're starting, you know, you're grief stricken because you've lost someone, or maybe you traded places with that person, or whatever, or maybe that. Then you get back and you think that civilians don't understand. They don't understand. How can we possibly understand? And would they really want us to understand their experience? No. And so trust is something that we need to build with each other. Trust means that, you know, they've got my back. They're not going to let me get hurt, or they're not going to hurt me, or they're not going to betray me. So trust is a very, very huge thing, and it requires a lot of work and a lot of reassurance. And as we know, too, some of the issues are related to some of the relationships that may be going on while they're not at home. So the trust issues between couples is a big issue. So and in friendship, isn't it a good friendship based on trust? Like, you could just tell all your deep, dark secrets to your buddy, and there would be no ramifications for that they would love you unconditionally. So with a warrior, they have a lot of conflict, moral conflict. And there's a quote that I just love, and it's by David O. McKay. He says, "The most important of life's battles is the one we fight in the silent chambers of our soul." So with trust, they think, can I really trust that I can share this information with someone that hasn't been there or done that, and they won't judge me because I'm judging myself? I don't like myself very much maybe right now because of what I did, what I didn't do, what I saw, what I could have done. And so trust also comes back to themselves and how much they love themselves and how much they can forgive themselves. So trust, forgiveness, internal moral conflict, all those things are like intertwined together like a big piece of wire. And you have to slowly unwind those things. And you have to earn trust.
And we're observing on our Facebook group page that with nothing to do with us, I mean, we're not veterans, nothing to do with us, these women are really, really healing to each other.
They're connecting. And see, our internet, that's a whole new kind of dimension out there, because they can connect and they have a community. It's an online community, so they know they're not alone. And it's tremendous healing when you know you're not alone.
In an ideal world, what would you say is the best way to help our veterans when they leave their service and return home in dealing with PTSD? In an ideal world, what would that be?
And I've been doing this for 20 years. My dream is to have a veterans retreat. This is an ideal world, so you're asking me almost like a magical question. But I hope to have this happen someday. Have a veterans retreat where my veterans can come and they can live on the property and they can be with animals, they can be with horses, they can have their gardens, they can have community, they can have campfires where they sit around and talk, they can go out and hang out in the hammock in a tree, they can go down by the stream and go fishing. They can bake, can cook, they can listen to music, they can lay in bed if they want and just relax. They can get all sorts of care. So, and then when they feel ready, they can launch themselves back out into their communities. So in a real ideal, idealistic, magical way, to me, that would be the most wonderful way for our warriors to come home. It's where they come home to people that have, that really truly there for them 100%. Not because they say, oh, I want to be veterans, but truly have the heart and the compassion and the empathy to stand in the fire with them and help them transition through these very difficult times and know that they're going to be okay. They're going to get through this. And when they're not alone, they're going to do it as a team, and we're going to stand behind them and hold their hand while they do that. That, to me, is the most beautiful way that we could bring our warriors back home, is through ceremony, through transitioning rites of passage, through communities that are well-educated and loving and informed and know that this is not an easy path. They should have jobs waiting for them. They shouldn't have to fight for their disability claims. They should be honored. They should be able to go to any medical provider in this country or outside this country and have full care at any time. So that, to me, is the ideal way to bring our warriors back from the war zone.
That's so beautiful that I think I want to end with that and add just that. You are so terrific. And every time we've done research on one of the people we want to have in these podcasts, and I read a book or I hear about them or I look at their Facebook page, I see your name either in the bibliography, in the dedication. I just want to tell you it's been an incredible honor interviewing you, and I want to thank you very, very much.